You're always most vulnerable after a victory. You're almost most vulnerable after a victory. And in that little video, Nehemiah is sort of summarized to this point where we meet him in the narrative. He'd been living in Babylon in the pleasures and success of all that he had earned and got there. He was one of the top guys in the society and culture of his day. But then in chapter 2, God put something in his heart. Something that was a God-shaped vision. That because he was a native Jew and that because he had Jewish blood flowing in his veins, God put something in his heart to go back and restore the people of God. Jerusalem was a disgrace. The bricks were all over the place. God's name, Yahweh himself, was not being honored and worshipped. The people were in disarray. It seemed like they had no hope. They'd lost their vision. They'd lost the greatness of God. Then in chapter 3, the building begins. Then in chapter 4, they have the halftime syndrome, where they get halfway through the project and the initial enthusiasm is starting to wear off. And then the people rededicated themselves to the work, and the men who were working in the walls had a trowel in one hand or a shovel in one hand and a spear in the other in case they were attacked from all the surrounding people and nations that wanted to oppose the rebuilding of the walls. Then once, in a sense, Nehemiah had put his finger on the hole at that point, then the pipe burst somewhere else, chapter 5. While all the men are out working on the wall and are away from their villages and towns, there's difficulties within. The people are fighting with one another. Jewish brothers and sisters are exploiting each other to make money out of each other. And there's a real famine in the land. Many families were having to sell their sons and their daughters to slavery just in order to keep their land. And suddenly there's an outcry and the women speak to their men and the men don't do anything. So they come to Nehemiah and say, Nehemiah, what are you going to do? This is all over the place. We have no money. We have no food. Doesn't matter about the walls. There's nothing going to happen because we're all going to die. So Nehemiah stops building, chapter 4, into chapter 5. He starts to heal the internal issues and the people rededicate themselves again. But you would just sort of think, well, Nehemiah has been through an awful lot. Maybe it's time that God would give him a break. Maybe you feel like that. You feel like you've fought many battles. You've been part of a victory and you sort of think, well, now it's time for rest. Now it's time to sort of recover. Well, unfortunately, you're always most vulnerable after another victory. Margaret Thatcher, you may have noticed, has been in the news in the last couple of weeks. And I'm sure she divides opinion even in a room this size. But she has some helpful things to say. Talking about leadership and rebuilding society in Britain, she said this. I always cheer up immensely if an attack is particularly wounding. Because I think, well, if they attack one personally, it means they have not a single political argument left. She also said this, if you want something said, ask a man. If you want something done, ask a woman. She said this, I'm in politics because of the conflict between good and evil. And I believe in the end, good will triumph. How true that was for Nehemiah. How true it is for you and I, whether you're a leader, a servant, whatever you want to refer to yourself. There's a battle going on between good and evil. And in this narrative, as we've exposed before, there are two unseen characters. Satan himself, who's trying to stop the work with all of his might. And God, the controller of the universe, who's trying to work all these things together for good. Satan is desperately trying to oppose the rebuilding of the wall. And so after this victory in chapter 5, Satan is going to do all that he can to attack Nehemiah. This is now a personal attack in chapter 6. It's a personal attack in chapter 6 against him as a leader in particular. You say, well, was it only that way for Nehemiah? No, it's always been that way for leaders, I believe. Jesus himself in Matthew chapter 3 had a moment of victory and a moment of triumph. There he was at his baptism and the Spirit of God descended like a dove and his Father spoke from heaven and said, this is my beloved Son in whom I am well pleased. And the Spirit of God was upon the Son, Jesus. And at the end of chapter 3, immediately in Matthew chapter 4, says Jesus was led into the wilderness to be tempted by the devil. Because you're almost most vulnerable after a victory. But the question is, how do we handle this? What's God's antidote? Well, I believe this is a theme in chapter 6. The antidote is God's strength and weakness. I believe the antidote is God's strength and weakness. Many of you this morning feel as weak as water. You have a situation that no one else knows about. You're trying to lead your family out of it, trying to lead a particular ministry in this church or outside of this church through it. In your workplace tomorrow morning, you can't even bear the thought of going in to try and lead your way through a problem or to be part of the leadership team to make this problem no longer a problem. And you need God's strength and weakness. Nehemiah needed it, and so did Jesus. And so did Paul. And in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 9, he said this, and in a sense, Paul, when he said this, was in a moment of angst, and he wants to have his own strength. He wants to be able to handle life in his own ability, and he sort of cries out to God with a terrible church at Corinth, how am I going to get through this? And God said to Paul in 2 Corinthians chapter 12, verse 9, but God said to me, my grace is sufficient for you, for my power is made perfect in weakness. Therefore, I will boast all the more gladly about my weaknesses. Why? So that Christ's power may rest on me. That is why, for Christ's sake, I delight in weaknesses and insults and hardships and persecutions and difficulties. And then he says these words which blow your mind. For when I am weak, then I'm strong. That is not the mantra of the world we live in. And here is Paul saying in his culture and generation, and we'll see Nehemiah in just a few moments' time looking to God's strength and weaknesses. And when we look at the life of Jesus saying, I've only come to do the will of my Father, I'm dependent upon him and dependent upon the leading and guiding of the Holy Spirit. It seems to be that there's a big theme throughout the Bible that God's strength is made perfect in weakness. But Nehemiah, chapter 6, verse 1, had to face it in the face of trickery. Trickery. Look at verse 1. When word came to Sanballat, Tobiah, Geshem, the Arab, and the rest of our enemies, that I had rebuilt the wall and not a gap was left in it, though up to that time I had not set the doors and the gates. Here's our friends. Sanballat and Geshem sent me this message. Come, let us meet together in one of the villages on the plain of Ono. But they were scheming to harm me. So I sent messengers to them with this reply. I'm carrying on a great project and can't go down. Why should the work stop while I leave it and go down to you? But four times they sent me the same message. And each time I gave them the same answer. The opponents of God's work and the opponents of God's people have done everything but personally attack the leader of the organization, the leader of God's people. And so their next trick is to lure Nehemiah away. Let's get him out to the plain of Ono. And you say, where was and is the plain of Ono? Well, it was equidistant from Samaria and Jerusalem. And at the same time, it was for Nehemiah more than a day's journey from the city. And at the very limit of his territory to the northwest, bordering the districts of Samaria and Ashdod. Since both of these were hostile regions, the plan smelt of treachery. They wanted to lure Nehemiah away from God's people and to isolate him away out in some plain, away out in the distance, a couple of days' journey away, where they would kill him. They would then send a message to King Artaxerxes away off back at the capital and say, there's been a very tragic accident. Nehemiah has died. They use every excuse here to try and lure him away. They say that Nehemiah, it'd be better for you to come. This is a friendly gathering. In a sense, we want to help you, Nehemiah. But Nehemiah wanted to stay dedicated to the task. He wanted no distractions. God in chapter 2 had placed something in his heart to rebuild the people, and he wasn't going to move. I read this week about a missionary in China who had so many natural abilities, God-given abilities. He was a man of outstanding talent, and many companies all around the world tried to hire him because they could see the ability within him. Many companies offered him an attractive job with a salary to match, but he kept turning companies down. He told them that God had sent him to China as a missionary. He thought that would be the end of the matter. But instead they came back with better and better and better offers and increases in salary, and he turned them down too. But again, they came back, doubling his financial package. Finally, he said to them, "It's not your salary that's too little. It's the job that's too small." You see, God had placed something in Nehemiah's heart. And that vision of God that he had was so big and so great, even in spite of all the difficulties, in spite of all the problems, in spite of all the issues, that wherever he turned, there was a hole in the pipe, and he tried to do them all, and he was completely exhausted, I'm sure. And many times God had placed something in his heart, and no one or nothing was going to distract him. What's God placed in your heart? Your big vision of God this morning. But you say, "I'm weak and I'm powerless." And God says, "You're the man or woman for the job. Because my power and my grace is made perfect and sufficient in your times of weakness." That's part of the qualification. Nehemiah says, "I'm not going to leave. God's called me to this task." But how the devil loves to dangle temptation, doesn't he? Should just come off the task for a minute or two. Just remove yourself from the rebuilding work for just a minute or two. Come out of that particular thing for a while. And so he tempts you with other things when you lose your focus on what God is wanting you to do. Nehemiah had a God-shaped focus to continue the work. So he had strength in the face of trickery. But now these boys reveal their true colours in verse 5. They now go for outright slander. Verse 5, "Then the fifth time, Sanballat sent his aide to me with the same message. And in his hand was an unsealed letter, in which was written, 'As reported among the nations, and Geshem says it's true, the Jew and the Jews are plotting to revolt. And therefore you're building the wall. Moreover, according to these reports, you're about to become their king. And I've even appointed prophets to make this proclamation about you in Jerusalem. There is a king in Judah. Now this report will get back to the king, so come, let us confer together.' I sent him this reply: 'Nothing like what you're saying is happening. You're just making it up out of your own head.' They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work, and it will not be completed. But I prayed, 'Now strengthen my hands.'" There was no Twitter, instant messenger, email, or any form of communication bar letters. And these boys, as we know, are tricky, aren't they? Sanballat, Tobiah, and the Arabs, who were all conspiring against God's work in Jerusalem. So when they sent this open letter, it does what it says in the tin. It's opened by many people. And so as this letter would have come from Sanballat and Tobiah to get to Jerusalem, it would have been opened by many different people in the surrounding nations, and they would have read about this so-called conspiracy theory that Nehemiah is planning. In fact, the people at Jerusalem were known for revolt. Because in Ezra chapter 4, the Persians actually stopped the rebuilding of the walls because there was rumors that they actually wanted to revolt against the kings of the known world. And so they take this sort of kernel of truth of the past people of God, and so they kind of take it and twist it all over the place to say that Nehemiah is actually planning to become a rival king in the known world. And so many people would have opened this letter, and slander and gossip would have been spread about him. I love the game Chinese Whispers. Some of you have played it. I just kind of like to throw the spanners in the work in Chinese Whispers, especially if you're halfway around the room. And you start with what is true, what the first person says to the second person. But if it's in a big room, by the time it gets to the end, it's completely not the truth normally. It's normally something completely random. And this is what's happening all around the walls of Jerusalem. Chinese whispers and gossip is being spread about what the people and their motive for rebuilding the wall is all about. But you know, in the church, the Bible calls Chinese whispers gossip. And it has a devastating effect on church life. It had a devastating effect on the people here. And I read in a psychology journal this week about why is it that people often in church and people outside of church love gossip? What is it about us? The journal said this, talking about one particular illustration in a workplace. Helena got a pay rise. I'm not surprised the way she flirts with the boss. Grumbles a colleague who'd like to be promoted herself. She thinks she's a skinny mini. I'm sure she's actually anorexic, replies her friend. So gossip spreads, things that are not true. However much we may disapprove in theory, it's a very common behavior. One particular psychologist said this, about 60% of conversations between adults are about someone who isn't present. And most of these are about passing judgment on the other person. They went on to say, we all know it's wrong to gossip and no one wants to seem malicious. So why do we indulge this guilty pleasure, they asked in the journal. They say gossip builds social bonds because shared dislikes create stronger bonds than shared positives. Two people who don't know each other will feel closer. If they share something mean about a third person, then if they say nice things about them, it's a way of demonstrating their shared values and sense of togetherness. There's almost a thrill to the transgression. They went on to say our appetite for gossip is insatiable. Sometimes the heart sinks as we hear the words, don't tell this to a soul, or here, just I'm sharing this for you for your prayers. And so gossip is spread. For the people of Jerusalem, it brought about devastation. And in a church, in this church or any other church, gossip will bring devastation. Where you take something that may have a kernel or an element of the truth and you share it with someone for their prayers and they share it with someone else for their prayers. And before you know it, there's a wildfire of gossip that can spread amongst the people of God. And what does the Bible have to say to us about this? Ephesians 4 verse 29 says, do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouth, but only what is helpful for building others up, that it may benefit those who listen. Proverbs 16 verse 28, a perverse man stirs up dissension and a gossip separates close friends. James 1 verse 26, if anyone considers himself religious and does not keep a tight rein on his tongue, he deceives himself and his religion is worthless. And then here comes the very, very, very convicting verse. Matthew 12 verse 36. But I tell you, that men will have to give an account on the day of judgment for every careless word they had spoken. I wonder how Sanballat and Tobiah would have felt if they had known these words that Jesus shared about the day when they would have to give an account. And as I challenge myself on Friday and as I challenge you this morning, what will you talk about over lunch? What will you say about this church? What will you say about your ministry? What will you say tomorrow morning at the coffee break with your co-workers? Will it be for the building up of others? Or will it be for the tearing down? God's people should be lifting up others and not tearing down. But it's lovely how Nehemiah responds to this gossip and this slander. Look what it says at verse 9. They were all trying to frighten us, thinking their hands will get too weak for the work and it will not be completed. But I prayed, now strengthen my hands. The work was so exhausting for Nehemiah. Trickery, slander and gossip. It seemed as if there was no way out. It seemed as if it was just going to be one problem after another. And Nehemiah could have said, Lord, I'm packing it and I'm done with this thing. I'm heading back to Babylon. It was easier there. Nehemiah says to God, here I am in my weakness. Strengthen my hands. Coming to you in prayer, Father, because I've got no answers. Strengthen my hands. I wonder, do you need to do that this morning? Your circumstance, And the word that is used in the New Testament for anxiety means to be pulled apart in the mind. And that's how you feel this morning. You feel like you're being pulled apart in the mind, and you need God to come and strengthen your mind and your heart. And Paul promised the church at Philippi, and if you do that, you'll know the peace of God that transcends your situation, that transcends your understanding. And you say, how will we do it? As we live in Christ Jesus. See, Nehemiah had a deep, intimate relationship with God. It said, God put it in my heart, and God led me here, and then God gave me discernment that these people were tricking me and slandering me. He had such a deep, intimate, vibrant relationship with God that when the trials and problems came, it was an instant communication with the Father. J.I. Packer said this about Nehemiah: to live peaceably, work steadily, lead victoriously despite the uncertainty of not knowing whether Artaxerxes would receive Sanballat's gossip letter. And this so whether he would believe it, and if he did, whether he would not recall Nehemiah for beheading, called for great grace. But when servants of God who find themselves in trouble humbly get on with the job God has given them to do, great grace is regularly given. One must commit one's cause to God and embrace the assurance that He will vindicate you in the end, whatever happens in the short term. But just in case you think it was going to get any easier, here comes treachery. Verse 10. One day I went to the house of Shimeha, son of Diliha, the son of Mithabatel, who was shut in at his home. He said, let us meet in the house of God inside the temple, and let us close the temple doors, because men are coming to kill you, Nehemiah, by night. They're coming to get you. But I said, should a man like me run away? Or should one like me go into the temple and save his life? I will not go. I realized, here comes the discernment of God, I realized that God had not sent him. But they had prophesied against me because Tobiah and Sanballat had hired him. He had been hired to intimidate me so that I would commit a sin by doing this, and that they would give me a name to discredit me. Remember Tobiah and Sanballat, oh my God, because of what they've done. Remember also the prophetess Noadiah, and the rest of the prophets who've been trying to intimidate me. Things can't get any worse. Here comes treachery from his own people. Here's a fake prophet. He says, Nehemiah, someone's coming to get you. You can find safety and lodging in the temple here. Just come on in, and sure, I'll look after you, Nehemiah. But it was a plan to kill him. There were rules in the Old Testament law that protected people, that they could find asylum in the temple. But from what we know about Sanballat and Tobiah, it's unlikely that these folks would have obeyed those laws. In fact, where this fake prophet tells Nehemiah to come was not where the Bible tells you seek asylum. It wasn't at the altar that you were to find asylum. It was another part of the sort of temple courts. And the last time someone did that, King Uzziah, earlier on in the Bible, he came out in leprosy and died a leper. So Nehemiah, as God's man who knew God's law, knew that this couldn't be right to disobey God's law. And so with all this in mind, God gives him the discernment to know that this is not of God. I love his response, verse 11. Should a man in my position run away? He said, what you don't realize is God's called me here. What you don't realize is that this is the vision that God has given me for my life. Why would I run? If God is for me, who can be against me here in the middle of a disaster of a project that is coming on day after day, and it seemed like we have opposition on every side? God has called me here, and I'm going to stay. Jesus did the same. From the very moment of the time on his earth, set about only to do the will of his Father, as he started his 3-year missionary stint, he said he had set his face like flint to go where? To Jerusalem. And it wouldn't be a physical temple, but it would be the temple of his body. that he would offer up and rebuild in 3 days. But they accused him of treachery. They tried to stop his ministry. They tried to stop God working through the life of his son. And in Luke chapter 13, verse 31, it says this: at this time, some Pharisees came to Jesus and said to him, "Leave this place and go somewhere else, or Herod is going to kill you." A little bit like Nehemiah, Jesus replied, "Go tell that fox, I will drive out demons and heal people today and tomorrow, and on the third day, I will reach my goal." Because God, through his son, had given him a mission, and he said, "I've only come to do the will of my father." He had set his face like flint to go to Jerusalem, saying, "I'm going to stay here until this work on earth is done." And I can ask you this morning, what's God called you to do? What big vision has he put in your heart? He's going to give you strength and weakness if you feel inadequate this morning. Nehemiah, Jesus, God's strength in their times of weakness. Jesus said to the crowds, "I don't care what you have to say, I've been given a mission, I'm going to do it." Nehemiah said, "God has called me to this fine building work, and I'm not moving until he calls me elsewhere." I wonder, is God even calling you this morning to stick a stake down here? Maybe you've been coming here for the last couple of years, and he's saying to you, "You know what? Let's become a member. Let's put down our stakes. Let's say, no matter what happens in this church in the future, that we are part of God's kingdom building work here in Hamilton Road and to the ends of the earth." And he's asking you this morning to say, "I'm going to stick my stake down." Or maybe you're a member and you feel on the outskirts and you feel on the outside, and God is calling you this morning to stick your stake down. To say, "I'm coming back into the center, and I'm going to re-engage, and I'm going to do what he wants me to do for this time and in the future." Nehemiah says, "I'm going to stick a stake down in spite of all of my weaknesses." But then comes the triumph, verse 15. God's strength even in times of triumph. Verse 15, "So the wall was completed." I just read that the other day and thought, I've been tired just reading it. Imagine having to go through it. "So the wall was completed on the 25th of Elul in 52 days, when all our enemies heard about this. All the surrounding nations were afraid, and they lost their self-confidence. Because they realized," I love this verse, "because they realized that this work had been done with the help of our God." That's why we need God's strength and weakness. Because if you or I were to do ministry, or to do our family lives, or to be in our workplaces, and we were to boast that it was all about our talent and our skills and ability and our strength, yet we as Christians realize that there's nothing that we've received that hasn't been given to us from God, and that all good and perfect gifts come from above, that we're able to say to people in our workplaces that it's God's strength in me that's able to do that, not in a pious way, but that it's God's strength and weakness. And that the surrounding nations all around the walls and all the opposition in turn, they're going, "There's no way that this could have worked unless God had been there. This work has been done with the help of Yahweh." Verse 17, "Also in those days there were nobles of Judah who were sending many letters to Tobiah, and replies from Tobiah kept coming to them. For many in Judah were under oath to him, since he was son-in-law to Shechaniah, son of Hariah, and his son Jehoniah had married the daughter of Meshulam, son of Berechiah. Moreover, they kept reporting to me his good deeds and then telling him what I said. And Tobiah sent letters to intimidate me." You would think that the devil would give up. The walls have been built. God's people are on the way to being restored. Surely, Satan, it's time for you to go somewhere else. But the Bible doesn't tell us that. In the life of Jesus, after he had been tempting him in the wilderness, it says this. Luke 4, verse 13. "When the devil had finished all his tempting, he left him until an opportune time." You see, the Bible tells me and it tells you that We have a God who neither slumbers nor sleeps. And the reason I think it tells us that is because we have a great opponent in the 21st century in Bangor. Satan himself, who's a liar, he's a deceiver. And God asked the deceiver where he had been, and he says, "I've been roaming up and down the earth." The church scattered all around Asia Minor, and 1 Peter. Peter wrote to the churches that you have a great adversary who's prowling around like a roaring lion looking for someone to devour. And Peter says, here's the antidote, but resist him firm in your faith. So even in triumph, we need faith. Even in the midst of triumph, we need faith and prayer. An old writer, Andrew Bonner, said this: let us be watchful after the victory, just as much as before the battle. Here was Nehemiah after another moment of great triumph. The walls have been rebuilt, and yet here still comes the adversary trying to oppose his people. I think Nehemiah is a model of prayer. Every time the opposition comes, he prays. God put it into his heart, chapter 2, he prayed. The opposition comes in chapter 3 and 4, he prays. The difficulties come within everyone fighting with one another in chapter 5, he prays. He's feeling weak in chapter 6, verse 9. He says, God, strengthen my hand. The opponents who were tricking him and slandering him, he says, God, you remember them. You're the judge of all the earth. And so this morning, if you feel under great temptation, pray. I love how it finishes, though, chapter 7. And we won't go through the genealogical order. But after the wall had been rebuilt, he set up the doors, and now Nehemiah goes about restoring the people. You see, the walls were never the end goal. The end goal was worship, that the temple would be restored, that Yahweh would be put back in the center of the people. And next door, we're not building a new building just to have a nice building. We're doing it that worship can be met with many more people. That many more people will come to Christ. That we will be God's missionary display people. That we will engage our community so that when these walls are built up and that the glass is built up, that we let people know that God is here. That God can supply your needs. And so that's what Nehemiah was doing. But I finish with a few words from good old Maggie Thatcher, whether you loved her or hated her. She said this: look at a day when you're supremely satisfied at the end. It's not a day when you lounge around doing nothing. It's a day when you had everything to do and you've done it. And Nehemiah at the end of this day could say, I've done the work that God has called me to do. And Christ on the end of his day on Good Friday could cry out, it's finished. Margaret Thatcher says, if you just set out to be light, you'll be prepared to compromise on anything at any time and would achieve nothing. Nehemiah set out to do what God had put in his heart, no matter what his opponents wanted him to do. And Christ also said that he had only come to do the will of the one who sent him, not the disciples, the Pharisees, the chief priests, or the teachers of the law. And she said, and I finish with this, you may have to fight a battle more than once to win it. How Nehemiah knew this. So many opponents, so many problems, so many battles, but were we to part from the words of Margaret Thatcher, while her words are helpful, this is what the Bible says. If God is for us, who can be against us?